Blog Talk Radio. This evening, and this is, as you just heard, Leslie Mitchell Clark. I'm so pleased that you have joined us this evening for Contact Radio, and from a remote location, but nonetheless, right here is my co-host and partner in crime, Mr. Wes Roberts. Good evening, Wes. How are you doing?
Hey, Leslie. I'm doing very well. I'm quite happy to be on the show.
Excellent, excellent. And is the chat room open this evening? I suspect that it may be.
I actually opened the chat room about 2 minutes ago.
Excellent. So, folks, this is a live broadcast this evening. We have been having some pre-recorded broadcasts of late simply because of the location of our wonderful guests, either in Australia or Europe or what have you. But we are all the way live tonight, and both Wes and I are thrilled that we are welcoming back to the program our dear friend, who is, of course, a researcher, author, lecturer, scientific ufologist, niece of the late Betty and Barney Hill, and director of MUFON's International Experiencer Research Program, as well as being on the board of FREE, Dr. Edgar T. Mitchell's organization, Kathleen Marden. We are welcoming back to the show. And, of course, on tonight's show, we're going to be talking about all kinds of things, and hopefully we'll be also discussing Ms. Marden's recent book that she's written along with Denise Stoner entitled The Alien Abduction Files, which are, you know, a series of really marvelous insights into what I believe are incidents of high strangeness, true abduction experiences. So we'll be talking about that. And we're also going to be talking about Ms. Marden's really landmark international MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, Experiencer Research Project. And we'll also be talking about, and this was some delightful news that Kathleen shared with me, we're going to be talking about the forthcoming Hollywood blockbuster film entitled Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which is based on her best-selling book, which she wrote with co-author Stanton Friedman, about the real-life extraterrestrial encounter experience of her late aunt and uncle, Betty and Barney Hill. So, a lot going on, folks, tonight. We're so very, very thrilled that Kathleen Marden is joining us. Now, if you would like to call in and have your comment or your question answered, if you are in if you are calling from Canada or Europe and elsewhere, please use our computer line, which is 1-424-220-1861. And if you are calling in from the U.S., please use our toll-free listener line at 1-888-891-3884. So, there we go. And, Wes, did you have anything to add? Just wanted to say hello, and we're getting ready for the Canadian Hypnosis Conference, which is happening next weekend.
Yes, absolutely. I know that we both have some joined reasons and some individual reasons for welcoming our guests tonight, and certainly it's near and dear to both our hearts, so this is really going to be something. For next week, yes, we're at the Canadian Hypnosis Conference. I'm not there as much as you'll be there, but Leslie and I will be presenting on a Sunday morning, and then we're being interviewed on a radio show right after that.
That's right. So it's going to be a great event. We have hypnotherapists and related practitioners, authors, experts from really all over Canada and elsewhere. And on Saturday, I'm just going to be hanging out and listening to some speakers, maybe taking some classes, and it's going to be a fabulous event. And as you said, then on Sunday, we will be presenting. So it's going to be a marvelous occasion. I believe this is the third Canadian Hypnosis Conference, I believe. And of course, our friend Joanne Eady is the creator of the event and propels the event, and we're most grateful to her.
Absolutely. That started us on a whole interesting, fascinating road, and here we are tonight.
That's right. And I can see on our little virtual switchboard that I believe that Ms. Martin is with us. But just before we bring her on, I did want to tell you a little bit about her. Kathleen Martin is a professional ufologist who is known around the world for her work as an alien abduction ET contact researcher, author, and lecturer. Her educational background in the social sciences has shaped her interest in scientific ufology. Extensive research and investigation into alien abduction has convinced her that abductions are not only real, but that they are being covered up by the world's governments. Kathleen earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in social work from the University of New Hampshire and participated in graduate studies in education while working as a teacher and education services coordinator. Her scholarship led to acceptance into the Alpha Kappa Delta Sociology Honor Society, and during her 15 years as an educator, she innovated, designed, and implemented model educational programs. She also held a supervisory position coordinating, training, and evaluating education staff. Interestingly enough, Kathleen Martin's fascination with UFOs dates back to September 20th, 1961, when her aunt, Betty Hill, phoned her nearby home to report that she and Barney had encountered a flying saucer in New Hampshire's White Mountains. A primary witness to the evidence of the UFO encounter and the aftermath, Kathleen has intimate knowledge of the Hills' biographical histories, investigation files, and scientific interest in their sensational experience. Betty's scientific contact experiments may have led to Kathy's memories of contact, memories that were undisclosed for nearly 50 years. So we're going to have to chat with her about that. And this led to a journey of exploration, leaving no stone unturned, and to answers through scholarly work, investigation, and social research. Kathleen Martin is associated with the Mutual UFO Network as Director of Experiencer Research and the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters, which is free, as I mentioned earlier, as an advisory board member and consultant to its research subcommittee. She is the recipient of MUFON's 2012 Ufologist of the Year Award, and Kathleen has written three books, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, along with Stanton Friedman, and Science Was Wrong, also along with nuclear physicist, scientific ufologist Stanton Friedman. And her most recent book, of course, is The Alien Abduction Files, written with Denise Stoner. And, of course, many of her essays have appeared in additional books. And in 2012, she spearheaded an extensive research project, along with Denise Stoner, to identify little-known commonalities amongst experiencers. Her articles have appeared and been published in MUFON UFO Journal, Open Minds, Alternate Perceptions, and Fate magazines, as well as several websites. And, of course, she has appeared on television and radio programs, you know, all over the world, U.S., Canada, Australia, the U.K., and she has lectured throughout the United States. And certainly Kathleen Martin is, without a doubt, recognized as the world's leading expert on the Betty and Barney Hill abduction. So we're going to hear all about that. So without further ado, I would like to welcome to our program Kathleen Martin, and we're bringing her online right now, I believe. Whoops, it looks like we've temporarily gone offline here for just a moment. I don't know why. Forgive me, we're having a little bit of a problem here.
Man,
we're going to bring Kathleen Martin on. Pardon me?
I think we're good now. I think we're good
now. You think
now.
We're
I
good?
In the studio. Yeah.
Okay. Wes, I see that I am not online, just at the second, so I'm going to, if you would just talk to the folks for about 30 seconds here about perhaps some of our guests we have coming up, Serge Grandbois and Carl Dory, I'm going to try to get us back online.
Sure. And are you on the line, Kathleen?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. So Leslie's signal must have just went down, so we apologize for that. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we're Leslie and I are really interested in Free, and we've both been dealing with Ray Hernandez on and off, so we're looking forward to contributing to the cause down the road.
Well, that's terrific news. And by the way, I want to thank you for the wonderful introduction that you gave me tonight. That was very nice.
Well, Leslie and I both feel strongly about the subject, not just Betty and Barney Hill, of course, but about the whole subject. And I'm also an abductee and experiencer. And as you know, Leslie's working her hypnotherapy magic with people like me as well. So it's amazing for us to have you on the show.
Well, thanks.
And
you know, it's great to be there with you.
Kathleen,
Leslie,
thank you so much
online?
For joining us. I am back. I'm here. We're online.
Terrific.
Wonderful.
Everything is a go. So, Kathleen, thank you initially so much for joining us. I know how very busy you are and all the things you have going currently. And I must say I am so excited when you expressed to me this wonderful news that there's going to be finally a big budget wonderful film about the experience of your aunt and uncle.
Absolutely. I am thrilled about it. Stanton Friedman and I had signed the motion picture contract several years ago, but it was sort of on the back burner. And then I guess it was about 3 weeks ago that Bryce Zabel informed us that he had joined forces with Gotham Productions,
mm-hmm.
and that the two of them were going to work together on this major production. It was big news because it made Variety out in Hollywood, and there was a huge media splash. And it's going to be different than the
mm-hmm.
first movie. The first movie, starring James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons, aired in 1985. It was a primetime movie on television. And it was based upon the first book that was written, The Interrupted Journey.
Yes,
those
John G. Fuller's book, right.
Yes. And those, the movie and the book are still under copyright agreement. So obviously this movie cannot be a repeat of that,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
any more than my book with Stanton Friedman captured is a repeat of The Interrupted Journey. It's entirely different because The Interrupted Journey focused upon the transcript of the hypnosis and the experience itself. Nothing that occurred after 1966 is in that book, and there was a tremendous amount of further contact and experiments and scientific analysis of the evidence and Betty's and Barney's lives in general that took place after that. So there's a
Indeed.
Lot of material for the new movie.
Well, I'm so excited. And ironically, I don't know whether I've ever mentioned this to you before, but at the time of the making of this, you know, TV movie, which actually was shot with the title Interrupted Journey, they changed it later. I was a tour guide at Universal Studios in charge of giving VIP tours. And I actually took these, you know, I took groups of people, little groups of, you know, financial people or otherwise, right onto the set of Interrupted Journey. And I happened to be fortunate to actually be there on the afternoon where they shot the chilling sequence where James Earl Jones, of course, and I believe that they took the I believe they took the dialogue, you know, either from the tapes or what John G. Fuller had the book had in the
yes,
book.
Yes, they did.
It was. I tell you, people were transfixed because whether or not, you know, James Earl Jones accepted the possibility of the reality that he was talking about, boy, it didn't matter a bit, because in that moment, you know, he was Barney Hill.
He was.
I mean, oh. And
he did a fantastic,
you know,
acting job.
Did he not? And Estelle Parsons, I mean, she even bore a physical resemblance to your late aunt, do you not think?
You think so? Oh, no.
Your aunt was much, much prettier, of course. But they had the hair. They had the hair right. They had the classic hairdo right. They sure did. Who would you like to see? And this is just, you know, who would you like to see? I mean, I have my own little ideas, but who would you like to see playing, if you could have any major, you know, actor playing both your aunt and your uncle at this time? Who would you like to see in those roles?
My gosh. You know, that is such a difficult question. I really don't know. I don't know. And I've been asked that question before, and people have recommended different people to me. But,
yeah.
You know, I guess that's going to be up to the producers of the show to determine who that is. And hopefully they'll be able to afford to have someone that's really very, very good in those roles.
Well, I know they will. I mean, I personally, if I had my druthers, I would love to see Julianne Moore playing your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to see either Don Cheadle, who might be a little young, or Lawrence Fishburne in the role of Barney.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yes. Well, too bad I'm not casting it, but there you go.
Uh-huh.
We'll have to wait and see, Kathleen. We'll have to wait and see, indeed. And now I have just... finished reading your most recent book, The Alien Abduction Files, which I found incredibly engaging. And I know that you've written this in collaboration with Denise Stoner. And perhaps without me droning on, you might like to tell our readers a little bit about this incredible story, series of stories, a series of recountings that are in your book. It's just fantastic.
Yes, they were some of my major cases that I've investigated over the years. And when I begin an investigation, it generally just, it goes on for years and years on end. I never drop that individual. And because, as you know, abduction experiences are ongoing. They occur periodically throughout a person's lifetime.
Yes.
So the longest duration of any case that I've worked on is that of Jenny Henderson, who
mm-hmm.
is in part two of the book. The book is divided into three parts. And
yes.
That began because Jenny Henderson and her family live in New Hampshire. She grew up in New Hampshire, and that's where I used to live. That's
yes.
where I grew up. And I had gone away to go to college and did some graduate work and ended up in Colorado for a while. But I moved back to New Hampshire in the mid-1980s, and I met Jenny not too long after that because she had been talking to my aunt, and Dr. James Harder, who was a friend of my aunt's and who was also the head of investigations for APRO, particularly abduction investigations. He was the major investigator on Travis Walton's case and was also very interested in the Hill case as well. He had worked with Jenny somewhat as well. And I ended up becoming involved in the ongoing investigation of her experiences over a number of years. Incredible woman. She was an educator, had two children. Her first husband unfortunately passed away in an accident. She remarried a no-nonsense businessman type of fellow. And prominent in the community. That is not her real name. She insisted upon anonymity, and for very mm-hmm. good reasons. And so this is the story of what appears to be a multi-generational abduction account with starting back to the time possibly when she was about 3 years old.
Yes.
And going throughout her lifetime, major significant event when she was 13, where there were some memories of the event, conscious, mm-hmm. continuous recall, and also pain, significant pain in her rectal genital area, so much so that she had to sit on a pillow the next mm-hmm. day. When she was a teenager, she and a friend were driving to attend a sports game. She was going to meet her younger brother and drive him home when a craft came in and hovered over the vehicle, came in very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And this was on a back road in New Hampshire. The engine died. They got the car started again and drove into the game and discovered that the school was shut down. There were no cars in the parking lot. And they were both very perplexed. The clock that they had in the car had stopped working. They had no way of knowing what time it was. So they drove to and found a local store that was open and discovered that it was hours later than they thought. And then, of course, she had to explain that to her parents. They knew she was a good kid. She was a Sunday school teacher. She was a class officer, you know, all of those things. And she, since the mother also had memories of having had these experiences, just said to her, "Don't ever tell anyone." And she didn't for many, many years.
Oh, my.
And these are ongoing experiences. Her children were both taken. Very, very distressing to her. She didn't know how to handle it. Didn't know what to tell them. She tried to pass it off as nightmares, but the kids knew that they weren't nightmares. She made a mistake there, she later realized. And the children both suffered greatly from this because they were going through this without support. They were simply being told that it was their imagination, that it was just nightmares. And
did the children seem to have more conscious memories than perhaps she had had as a child? In other words, were the children consciously experiencing these abductions and whatever went on, or was it just a feeling of dis-ease and fear before they went to sleep?
The children did have conscious recall. Her little girl said to her on one event, it was a major event in 1988, where Jenny had conscious recall because their dog, who was sort of like a watchdog, was barking ferociously. They heard sounds on the roof, and all of a sudden, the barking was cut off almost in mid-canine sentence, and then there was the rush of these ETs into the bedroom. Her husband sprang up out of the bed in a defensive mood and move and was put back down. And then paralysis started to creep up her body. And the next thing she knew, she was waking up the following morning. The texture of her hair had changed as if she'd been burned. Her eyes were red. When the tears ran down her face, it caused red trails. There were sort of like burn marks on her back and triangular, almost cutout kind of burn marks there. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of physiological evidence in her case. She went to the kitchen and walked past her son's handheld computerized little game, and it turned on automatically and started playing. One appliance after another blew out. You know, all of the things that we hear about occur in abduction experiences. And then her son walked out of the bedroom and said to her, "You know how I never believed that UFOs were real? Now I know they are." And she said, "What do you mean?" And he just turned around on his heel and went back into his bedroom. And she followed him in, and there was blood on his pillow. And he just wanted to be left alone. Her little girl, she went up to the little girl's room and saw blood on her pillow as well. And the little girl said that, you know, "Mommy, I almost came into your bedroom last night because there was an airplane outside my bedroom window, and it was so close I could see in the windows." And, and she said, "I decided not to do that because I didn't want to disturb you." It was that sort of thing. She found weapons underneath her children's mattresses, and these were farm kids. You know, these are kids out in the country who are safe and grew up in a safe environment, and the household knives were missing, and there they were under the mattress. It had a big impact, a huge emotional impact on the children and on her too. And it's a very, very long story of how they came to terms with all of this, and then also the information that Jenny has been able to receive from the ETs as the years passed, and she was able to acquire more information from them.
Indeed. And so the beings that were visiting Jenny and her family, pardon me, did they seem to be of one specific planetary origin, or were they a mix of, people who look like Terrans, look like us, and small grays, or was it all a consistently a similar type of being?
Jenny has not undergone a lot of hypnosis sessions, but from her memories, there appeared to be two types of grays, the short, the little short helper grays, the assistants and the guards, and then the taller grays who are the educators, the escorts, the physicians.
Yeah. Well, this, of course, as you well know, is not unusual to see, you know, collaborations not only amongst, you know, gray species, but I think even in the case of Travis Walton, you know, although it was totally represented in a completely imaginative and different way in the film about his experience, he himself has said that there were grays, as you would typically think of them, but also humanoid beings who were there to escort him, and you know, I think that one of the most fascinating things about this kind of work that you are doing, Kathleen, is the incredible variety. Well, there are commonalities, huge commonalities, but the variety of experiences that people are having, they can be anything from kind of like what you described, which is very physical, sort of based in the third density, and obviously there's a goal or something, or genetic research situation that's going on with the beings, or there can be, you know, experiences that I would have to call etheric, or experiences with what you might call ultra-terrestrials, beings that are almost not in physical bodies, that are light beings. So there's a really wide variety of experiences that people are having, I'm finding.
And I'm finding that as well. That is something that really came out on a follow-up study that I did after the Marden-Stoner commonality study. And this was, I called it an ET technology study. And it was more open-ended and shorter than the first questionnaire that had 45 questions. And on the second one, in phase two, I asked for people to describe the beings, to describe the sensations they felt, to describe the interior of the craft, to describe any technology they were able to observe. And yes, there was a variety of responses that really convinced me that it certainly was not limited to physical contact.
Indeed, that's the case. And even your own aunt, if I remember this correctly, described the beings that were involved with her and Barney as small humans. She didn't really talk about them as grays, as you know, as being so incredibly, you know, foreign or alien looking. She said they were small humans. Is that accurate? Is that what Betty said?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
Betty was trying to draw a distinction between the little stereotype of the earlier grays that we heard so much about back in the 80s. And, mm-hmm. you know, grays with no emotions, grays that were little wisps of things. That sort of thing with the huge black eyes. And that's not what Betty saw. But she did see, she and Barney encountered a variety, I have to say, of a race of gray. And in all of the individuals, and I've probably interviewed more than 1,000 at this point, of all of those individuals, there are variations in the physical descriptions of grays. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of what Betty and Barney saw, and I have their written description of what they saw, they were hairless. Their mm-hmm. heads were larger in proportion to their bodies than humans. They had large eyes that extended around to the sides of their heads. The pupil was very, very large, as was the iris, with just mm-hmm. a little bit of yellow showing around the edge. Just a tiny, tiny nose that was almost not there, a slit for mm-hmm. a mouth, no external ear. Their torso was sort of barrel-shaped, almost like, they described it as having a large chest cavity. Mm-hmm. But they described the arms and legs as being spindly, very, very tiny, with mm-hmm. These long fingers. And so that's more or less a description of the grays, but when you look at the original drawings, the forensic drawings that were done by the New Hampshire artist, they look more human. And the only way that I can explain that is in what I read in his letter to Betty and Barney. And what he wrote is that he had done the forensic drawings based upon his knowledge of human anatomy. And as you know, ET anatomy is not the same as human anatomy.
Right.
And so, you know, large chest, he thought, well, it must have really been large arms and legs then. But that's not what Betty and Barney described.
Right.
Betty described beings that exhibited emotions, that were sorry for frightening her, who were reassuring her that they meant no harm, that they were only going to do a few simple experiments and then mm-hmm. Betty and Barney would go about their way. You know, that sort of thing. So we now hear more and more about grays who are making the same comments, who are mm-hmm. reassuring, who are beginning mm-hmm. to show emotions. And I don't know if that has always been the case or if they have used human DNA to
humanize themselves, if you will. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
maybe that's something that they desire.
Maybe it is. And I think one of the things that I'm sure you've found this out, you know, in your many, many, you know, many, many explorations and your research, you know, we have a lot of hybrid beings starting to pop up. I've had individuals who talk about going to classes that are being conducted by obvious hybrids who maybe live on board but, you know, are very closely human and maybe could even pass on certain circumstances. So we have several generations of whatever genetic work these beings have been doing. You know, I mean, we have many generations now, and generation doesn't even apply because they've certainly been involved in some type of, you know, cloning situation, for lack of a better term. So we're seeing hybrid beings in addition to, I would say, you know, beings that are authentic for wherever they come from.
Yes. And, you know, and perhaps Betty's and Barney's grays were early stage hybrids. I don't know.
Yes.
Maybe. The answer to that, you know, that's a matter of speculation. But the little beings on the craft were definitely small grays.
Yes.
They were acting
as guards. Yes. Kathleen, we're going to take a little tiny pause just for a second, just for some sponsor thanks. And when we come back, we're going to continue to talk about your wonderful book. I have some more questions about Betty and Barney Hill. And we'll be right back in just two shakes with Kathleen Marden. Okay, having a little bit of trouble here once again. Pardon me. So in case there we go.
Contact Radio would like to thank its generous sponsors, James Borg and Euphoria and the Euphoria Chronicles, Variety Store Productions and Mr. Greg Summer. That's VarietyStoreProductions.com. The 2015 Canadian Hypnosis Convention and the 2016 Alien Cosmic Expo, and also EarthMysteryNews.com. Thank you for your incredible support. We could not do this without you.
All right, and we are back on contact with Kathleen Marden, author, director of MUFON's Experiencer Research Project. Kathleen, tell me, with regard to Betty and Barney Hill, do you think that they were simply in the wrong place, wrong time, or do you think that either Betty or Barney had a history that might have involved previous contact?
From what I know now, I believe that probably Betty had a history of alien contact that she did not remember. I'm not sure if this was true of Barney as well. Betty and Barney never believed that. They thought that they were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, that they had shown interest in this craft when they stopped to look at it. And they thought that that's why they were taken. But as you know, most experiences are generational.
And yes.
I suspect, and they begin when the person is young. And so I suspect that it might have happened many, many years before 1961.
Well, that certainly would seem logical, would it not? I mean, it would be far more unusual if it were an isolated experience. Those are, I'm not sure they even exist, to tell you the truth.
I'm not sure that they are either. I have to tell you, on the 2012 Marden-Stoner Commonality Study, of the individuals, we had 50 experiencers who participated in the study and 25-person control group. And of those 50, two believed that they had been contacted only one time. And those two had characteristics that were entirely different than the other 48.
That's very interesting, isn't it? And the commonalities that you have found, Kathleen, could you just sort of elucidate on that a little bit? What do experiencers have in common that could really denote what they've been through or a suspicion of what they've been through?
Well, most experiencers have some conscious recall of at least one experience. Most have had close encounters with flying saucers or UFOs at close range. Most have conscious, continuous recall of at least one time observing a non-human entity. Most have had ongoing paranormal experiences, in their homes that seem to be somehow related to this extraterrestrial contact. And it seems to happen within close proximity of the time frame that the contact occurs. Most state that they feel what they think might be an implant in their bodies. Most have had this electromagnetic interference immediately after a contact experience where one appliance after another or a light after another might blow out. Their computers malfunction. Many can't wear watches. One of the men even stated that he punched in on a time clock when he went to work in the morning. And whenever he had an experience, the time clock would malfunction for him, but for nobody else. Some people mention that when they, after an experience, when they go to the grocery store, the scanner doesn't work when they're standing near it, malfunctions. That sort of thing. Many experiencers, I believe it was over 50%, stated that they had either been healed or had, at least for a short period of time, developed the ability to heal others, which is very
well. Isn't that fascinating?
Well.
Yeah, that's. In fact, Wes, are you listening to this? I bet you are. Are you there, Wes?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
We were just speaking. Kathleen was just talking about how some experiencers had in the questionnaire had mentioned that they had either the ability to heal themselves or others, and certainly yourself as an experiencer, this is something that you've been kind of working with of late, isn't it?
It's actually fascinating. You know, it's sort of jaw-dropping to me because I had no notion of such a thing up until about 4 or 5 years ago, which incidentally was the time I began seeing you, Leslie, and exploring some experiences that I consciously remembered. So I'm listening to what Kathleen is saying, going, yes, 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 you know, a no in there somewhere, but mostly yeses. And the whole healing thing just came up as a sort of an experiment. I just felt something happening to me and something emanating from my hands. And I started to experiment with some friends and colleagues. And I don't do it often, but every single time I've done it, it has worked. Even on me, it has worked. And the only thing I can connect the dots to is the exploration of my alien experiences and that.
And indeed, Wes, I recall you telling me that you yourself had a rather fascinating experience when you were in hospital as a teenager with pneumonia, and you experienced a healing visitation, did you not?
Yeah, I did. It was kind of odd because I was able to recover quite quickly, but I recall being in a situation, don't know how I got there, I was in a situation laying on what seemed to be a gurney or a stretcher in a little room, and something like a doctor, or that was appearing to be a doctor, you know, whose white jacket didn't quite fit exactly, almost putting his or its hands into my chest. And then it wasn't long after that, it's like, oh, I'm better now. You know, it was probably a matter of days or something.
Very
interesting.
Isn't that interesting, Kathleen, that we have, there are interventions, there are healings going on, I think, with individuals who are experiencers, they're being more or less assisted or saved on various occasions.
Yes. And that has been reported to me many times. In fact, there's an experiencer that I have been working with now for close to 3 years, and I received some very upsetting news from him last spring that he had a lump on the side of his neck, and it didn't go away with antibiotics, and then there was a biopsy done and by an oncologist, and it was inconclusive about whether or not it was cancerous, but he had to go before a surgical team and had to have it removed. Well, mm-hmm. before it was removed, there was a light orb that entered his bedroom, and this was caught on camera. Mm-hmm. And that light orb moved across the room and dove down into his body, and then it came shooting out. He slept then for many, many hours, and when he awoke, the size of that tumor was greatly reduced. And by the time he went in for surgery, there were only two necrotizing nodes that had to be removed.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank God. And how is he doing now today?
He's doing well.
Oh, bless his heart.
No
Isn't
more
that something?
Symptoms. Yes.
Oh, that is incredible. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. Kathleen, when Betty and Barney had their primary experience, did Betty communicate with the beings telepathically? Because I know she said they sort of talked or said, but was this a telepathic communication, or were they actually verbalizing to her?
It was telepathic conversation. She was a little confused mm-hmm. about that because she had had a series of dreams, and then she had the real experience, and she tended to get them a little bit confused from time to time, particularly as she grew older. But I do have the hypnosis tapes. I've listened to them many, many times and transcribed mm-hmm. them as well for the comparative analysis that mm-hmm. I did. And Dr. Simon asked Betty if their lips were moving when they communicated with her. And she said no. She understood them in English, but she did not see their lips move. And Barney said the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so apparently it was telepathic communication.
Indeed. And now looking back, I mean, these are dear members of your family, and why do you think that Betty and Barney seem to have different emotional repercussions as a result of this experience? I mean, all you have to do is look at Barney in these pictures following 1961, 62, and you just sort of see the pain in his face. And certainly he left us like way too young. I mean, what do you think was the component there that made it so traumatic for him?
There were a number of things that occurred in Barney's life. When we're talking about the experience itself, he was the one who had conscious, continuous recall of observing non-humans staring down at him as he stood in a field in northern New Hampshire looking up at the craft that was hovering less than 100 feet away from him. Mm-hmm. Betty was seated in the car. She was still in the passenger seat in the car. The interior light was on. She didn't see those non-humans. Barney felt very frightened and very threatened at that point. He said that he felt as if he were going to be captured like a bug in a net. He tried to pull the binoculars down away from his eyes, but he did so with great difficulty after mm-hmm. pleading to God to help him to move those binoculars down from his eyes. He ran back to the car screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured. And then as he was running back, the craft hovered again over their vehicle. And he told Betty to roll down the window and look up. She was expecting to see the lights when she did that. All she saw was blackness. It was like looking into a black void. And then suddenly she and Barney heard a series of code-like buzzing sounds striking the trunk of their vehicle. And that is when this tingling sensation passed through their bodies. And it reminds me of the tingling sensation that passes through experiencers' bodies today, just before they're taken. And the car vibrated. And the next thing they knew, they were 35 miles down the road with very little memory of what had happened in the interim. You know, so indeed. Barney had that conscious, continuous recall of the non-humans. Betty did not. She only saw the craft close up.
Yeah.
We have to remember, too, that Barney was a soldier during World War II. He was injured. He was released in fair condition. And he was a black man growing up in a segregated society where, you know, growing up in the South in danger of being captured and the terrible things that happened to young black men who were perceived as stepping out of line.
For a young black man with a white woman.
Yeah.
That's right. That was a huge. I mean, Kathleen, you're just a young whippersnapper, but I'm old enough to actually. I was telling this to someone today who was incredulous because I'm in Canada, and that's incredulous enough that racism and what goes on in the South. But I am old enough. In my early professional career, I was traveling with the new Tommy Dorsey band, and we were in the South, and there were still segregated washrooms. Colored washrooms, colored entrances. And this would have been, you're going to be shocked when I tell you, this would have been like the mid-70s. I mean, these things had not changed where they didn't have to change. Everyone thinks that the civil rights movement occurred. You know, we've got Kennedy and blah, 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 and it all shifted in a day. Well, you know, the racism and the horrific ignorance and the other things going on that perpetuate racism didn't go away that quickly. And they still, in some instances, have not gone away. So it's very understandable the way Barney felt. And, in fact, I think the great James Earl Jones, when he was asked about his interpretation of Barney in an interview, there was a nice little film that, actually, I think you were there. There was a conference. Stanton was there in New Hampshire commemorating.
Oh, in Exeter, New Hampshire. Yeah.
Yes, in Exeter. We were all there, and there was some kids had made a nice little film, and there were some sequences where Estelle Parsons and James Earl Jones spoke, and James Earl Jones specifically talked about, in his mind, he understood that Barney was reacting to that whole amalgam that we just talked about. Racism, separatism, having maybe a white wife, I mean, whatever was in his subconscious mind, and the idea of being captured and maybe lynched, and that's how James Earl Jones played it. And I'm not sure, I'm not convinced it isn't very close to the truth.
I think that you're probably right about that. I mean, there were concerns, and legitimate concerns.
Indeed.
Though, I mean, it wouldn't happen in New Hampshire or in the North where they lived. But I have to tell you, Betty and Barney were very politically involved.
Yes.
He was even appointed to serve on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, State Advisory Committee. He received an award from Sergeant Shriver for the work he did through the Office of Economic Opportunity to improve the lives of New Hampshire citizens. And he and Betty and I were invited to Lyndon Johnson's inauguration. We went, and the three of us visited Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia. And when we were at the cemetery, they suddenly realized that it was illegal for them to be married in the state of Virginia. So there was a conversation about that. And, you know, how should they handle that? And should Betty and I ride in the back seat of the car and Barney be the driver, or what were we going to do? And in a vote of defiance, the three of us decided to ride in the front seat of the car with Betty seated next to Barney and me seated next to Betty.
Good. Good for you. That was the most wonderful thing that you could do. Absolutely. So we have to remember the times. They were part and parcel of what Barney experienced, and you said his military background, and certainly with that conscious tape running, we could really say maybe in retrospect that Barney was really suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, I believe that he was, yes.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. As many of these individuals who are having experiences are, you know, especially if they're still in a place of fear. Now, have you found, Kathleen, that as a commonality amongst the many experiencers you've interviewed and interacted with, that they have a kind of a, they're given kind of a point of being able to either say, yes, I'm going to go forward, or no, I don't want to participate anymore? Because this is certainly something that I've found, that there are many experiences, there's even a kind of a council that may involve even multiple types of beings, and it almost seems like there's a, what is it you call it, when someone reaches an age of majority, and it happens in the teen years. I know Wes has talked about it. He was about 17, I think. Many of my other clients have talked about it. Have you found this in your research as well?
I have not. Very interesting and new to me. And I have spoken with many individuals who would like to have this stop, and it's ongoing. And I've really, you know, there are suggestions that people have used in an attempt to stop this from occurring. And in fact, one of the women that I worked with received about a 14-year reprieve from being taken. Mm-hmm. After she expressed a desire not to be, or at least mm-hmm. she didn't remember it for 14 years. But then they came back again.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something that I've heard a number of times. I'm not sure which beings are allowing this decision-making process, but it also seems that some individuals are really involved in a collaboration of sorts. You know, once you take away the fear and the twisted memories of childhood and the twisted up conscious memories, there seems to be some sort of joint project going on with it. In fact, Wes, would you like to speak to that for just a moment?
Yeah, sure. I'm also clock watching here, so I don't want to take up a lot of our time, but there have been at least two or three incidents when, under hypnosis, I found myself in front of a council of some kind, in some kind of a room, basically being asked if I felt I was ready for the next stage, and whether or not they felt I had integrated whatever had been happening to that point. And in every case, in not possession of my waking consciousness, I said yes.
Very interesting.
Right. Yes. We'll talk about that further, Kathleen, for sure. And I can certainly provide you with any data or any people that you might like to talk to who've had that experience. So, but I think it's a very positive thing. It really takes the victim mentality, you know, out of the equation. And it seems to be very powerful when people are able to recall this sort of decision-making time where they were given the choice, you know, can we move ahead together in this awareness project, or would you rather not? So It's fascinating for sure. One last question I would like to ask. Oh my goodness, how does the time fly? Boy, I wish the show should have been a couple hours. That's for sure. did Betty or Barney feel that they had received implants, or did Betty ever discuss that? Or,
you know, Betty was a very skeptical person, and she couldn't imagine that the ETs would have implanted her with a tracking device or a communications device. But there is something that happened in the conversation that she had with the leader as he was walking her back to the car, where she said to him, I'm not a well-educated person, even though she had a college degree. She said, there are other people that I'd like to have you talk with, scientists. And he said, well, the decision is not mine to make. Maybe we can come back and maybe we can't. And she said, well, if you do, how will you find me? And he said, we can always find those that we want to find. So
yeah.
It sort of leads me to believe that perhaps she did have an implant.
Perhaps
and
so.
And maybe on September 19, 1961, it was just her time to be visited again.
Yes, indeed, Kathleen. It sounds very appropriate to me. Anyway, I just want to thank you. Wes and I both want to thank you so much for joining us this evening. It's been illuminating, and I look forward to having you on again, before too long. Thank you so much to Kathleen Martin. If